Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this episode we are going to have a health special. We're going to be talking to Heather Mills about the UK's ambulance services in crisis, and we'll be talking to MD, Dr. Phil Hammond, about where the NHS goes after COVID, why there have been such enormous delays across so much of the health service, and what can be done about them. We will also be talking to Solomon Hughes about a very mysterious deal between a British firm and Saudi Arabia, which the UK government is backing, but which the UK government won't actually tell anyone about. That's coming up later. But first, health. Last month, every single ambulance service in England declared a simultaneous emergency status. There have been multiple stories across the media about bed shortages, social care shortages, financial shortages, and there have been lots of reports of ambulances stuck outside A&E waiting to discharge patients into hospital. And Heather Mills has been writing in particular about the ambulance situation. And I asked her, first of all, what the core problem is in the ambulance service at the moment. Here's Heather.
So like the rest of the NHS and indeed social care, it's been starved of resources over the last 10 years. You know, it's faced cuts in real terms. And yet at the same time, they've got, you know, a big increase in demand. And this has all come to a head with COVID, of course, you know, which just multiplied their pressures. And even though now, you know, the initial crisis around COVID has perhaps passed, people who weren't seeking doctors' help generally during COVID, you know, have now got lots of serious conditions that suddenly require ambulance services. So they've got huge demand. I mean, it's gone up astronomically and they haven't had the resources. So, you know, it's those combined things. But the government has recently thrown 150 million at it to deal with this current crisis. But it takes a long time to train paramedics. But even if you could magically get all these new staff on board immediately, there's a bottleneck in the system. And that's caused all these long, long queues of ambulances that we've seen outside hospitals all over the country. These ambulances can't unload their patients. And if they're sitting outside hospitals with their patients on board, they then can't go and pick up other emergencies when they need them.
I see. So it's a problem that then leads to a cascade of problems further down the line. And one of the interesting things in your recent piece was that you pointed out what the fundamental problem is, which is too few beds actually in the hospital. That's the reason that these ambulances can't unload their patients into the hospital. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, also during these 10 years, hospital bed numbers have been cut back generally. But what's also happening is something the government, you know, has consistently failed to deal with. And that's the number of people who are well enough to be discharged from hospital, but not well enough to go to their homes and who need social care. And there aren't the places for them. So they are taking up beds that, you know, sick people need. So currently it's about 1 in 8 beds that would be free to take in these emergency people, but they can't because they're occupied.
As if this wasn't a big enough problem already, another of the problems you identified is that a lot of the money that has been promised hasn't yet arrived in the system. So you mentioned that there was a contract advertised in May for £30 million, which was a kind of surge capacity element with private ambulance firms, hasn't been awarded yet to any firm. So that money is effectively waiting there.
It's waiting there. But again, you know, that's to provide an extra service. And the service would be great, but unless you free the beds or create more bed space, you're still going to have those blockages at the hospitals.
What are hospitals supposed to do? Because you mentioned in the latest edition of the magazine, an NHS letter which says all systems unable to offload ambulances within 30 minutes should take further steps to create capacity within acute hospitals to ensure the rapid release of vehicles. How?
Yes. Yeah, good question. I mean, that's perplexed. You know, the hospitals that are already struggling because they are short staffed. They don't, you know, even if they could create the beds and the space, they haven't necessarily got the staff because, you know, there's a chronic shortage of medics and nurses and healthcare workers. So, yeah, good question indeed.
Heather Mills there. The ambulance shortages are one thing, but as she alluded to, that's only one of the things that the NHS is having to deal with at the moment. Another, of course, is the enormously long waiting list. There are over 6 million people who are now waiting for treatment of some kind or another. Privatised medical correspondent Phil Hammond, aka MD, has been writing about all the NHS's various struggles at the moment, not just ambulances, also waiting lists, which, as we know, are extremely long, and various other problems. The good thing, of course, is that despite the fact that COVID exacerbated these problems very badly, now that the pandemic is over, we should be able to see the NHS getting back on its feet. I asked Phil to confirm this and just make sure that everything was all right. Now the pandemic is definitely, definitely over. Here's Phil.
It's certainly not all over. And to be fair to Chris Whitty, he did say at the very beginning that it was here to stay. Chris Whitty was asked when the pandemic would end, and he said, "I don't know. I'm not a journalist," which is the best piece of trolling I think I've ever heard. So it's clearly here to stay. And coronaviruses, because they are so wonderful at mutating, they tend to evade vaccines and keep going and keep mutating. And there are three possible scenarios. The most hopeful scenario is it ends up like the common cold coronaviruses, of which there are four. They still occasionally kill older people, as respiratory viruses do, but generally don't cause as much harm. We don't realize we've got them. We live in perfect harmony together for the rest of time. The second scenario, perhaps it's a bit more like an influenza thing in that it causes significant deaths every year, and we have to get a booster vaccine if you want a booster vaccine, which won't be entirely effective. We have to sort of guess which variant's going to come up each year, like influenza. And the most unpleasant one is that it keeps varying. I mean, we were absolutely taken to the cleaners by Omicron in that there are almost 30 mutations around the spike protein, which is the device it uses to get into cells. And we just didn't see that coming. There were so many mutations, it was almost as if we were treating a different virus. The good news is that it appears to be less virulent in terms of deaths. The bad news is it still can cause significant long COVID. And because it is so spreadable, most people now, even if they've had vaccines, have also had natural infection. And most of the people who haven't had vaccines have also had natural infection. Yeah. So the science of figuring out whether vaccines work, whether vaccines plus natural infection works, whether you still need to keep having boosters is incredibly complicated, and lots of angry scientists are fighting about it on Twitter. So it's still here. I think the most lasting effect of it, I guess, is that because we just let it spread, so we just said, oh, we're going to do jabs only, and we're not going to prioritize ventilation or air filtration or proper masks like FFP2 or above in hospitals. Loads of people have got it in hospital, far fewer on intensive care and dying from it. But of course, in hospital, you still have to isolate these people. And when the staff get it, they have to go off sick. And so part of the NHS crisis, although people aren't being ventilated for COVID anymore, is that we just let it run free. Staff are off sick. Loads of patients have it. And of the people admitted with COVID, you know, perhaps half are admitted because the COVID's made them ill and half have it coincidentally, but they all need to be isolated in the hospitals with no space and not enough staff. So it's added to the NHS crisis, which I guess is its most prevalent effect at the moment.
There has been so little discussion of COVID in a broader sense recently, and it feels like that's certainly partly to do with fatigue, partly to do with the sense that people just don't want to hear any more of it, and partly maybe a sense that the two leadership candidates remaining are keen to move the country on to the next lot of sunlit uplands.
You might say that the constant daily death reminders spread fear and anxiety, and it's now fairly clear that that wasn't helpful. You may remember in my early Private Eye columns, although I thought we needed to do something to flatten the curves and we needed to minimise indoor contacts, I was quite strongly saying we should try and get people COVID fit. We shouldn't lock them all up in multi-generational households together to spread the virus amongst themselves. We should say, go outdoors as much as you want, play, get COVID fit, lose a bit of weight, chat to each other, improve your mental health, do your clangers, connect, learn, be active, notice, give back, eat well, relax, sleep. Things I've been prattling on about for 20 years that nobody takes any notice of. But I saw the, you know, the waves as a way of actually improving our health rather than locking people up in isolation. And we now know the risks of harmful drinking. Harmful drinking went up 20%, not just in Whitehall, and those levels have persisted. Younger people started smoking, huge levels of anxiety and self-harm, late diagnoses. There were things that we could have mitigated and handled better, but because the government panicked and chose fear and anxiety as its messaging, they made a lot of these conditions worse than they needed to be, I think.
And just to bring us back to the NHS crisis that you mentioned, it's obviously hardly perennial that there are lots and lots of headlines about NHS crises in winter, but the summer one is obviously a little more unnerving because this is traditionally supposed to be a time of year at which the Health Service is not under enormous, enormous pressure.
And it annoys me it's not being mentioned more. I mean, all the people who are going to be voting for our next leader, I mean, quite a few of them probably go private, but they'll find even these days if they go private, it's a bit like the NHS because everyone is trying to go private to jump NHS waiting queues. So private hospitals are look like NHS hospitals used to. I think what's clearly different about this is the British are used to waiting for stuff. You know, waiting lists have always been, you know, when I first qualified, you could wait 2 years for your hip operation and, you know, waiting lists over 6 million is pretty staggering, but the British generally suck it up. I think what's really scary is that we always thought the NHS would be there for us when we most need it. So it's the safety net in an emergency. And I think what's scary now is that the response times for heart attacks and strokes for an emergency ambulance that should be 18 minutes or less are now averaging 51 minutes with huge variations. And we know if you have an extreme emergency like a heart attack and a stroke, there's like a golden hour to, you know, you can dissolve the clot, you can take the clot out, you can dissolve. It's the most amazing thing in the world. If you've ever seen somebody with a stroke have the clot removed, there was a chap recently, a friend of mine was a chap, was playing with his grandchildren, had a very dense left-sided stroke, got into hospital really early. They removed the clot and he was back playing with his grandchildren in a day or so. I mean, that's almost unheard of miracle, but it requires speed. And the trouble now is if you don't get early treatment and intervention for your heart attack or stroke, the outcomes are much worse. So we're seeing a persistent spike in excess deaths, which aren't related to COVID and are probably related to people having trouble accessing urgent care. And obviously the heat wave didn't help because heat kills.
But when you say unrelated to COVID, obviously they're not directly related to COVID. No. Obviously, the pressures on the service are...
They're indirectly are largely, related to COVID because COVID... Yeah, I mean, all these things, it's like some... You know, it's all very complex. Everything's related to everything else.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting is that deaths at home are happening. So perhaps that people aren't calling for help because they're thinking it won't come anyway, or they're dying before. And that even seems to be happening in more affluent areas. So there's a whole mess of death. I know we are all going to die, but, you know... Dying before your time is what we're trying to avoid. I think a fair amount of that is going on at the moment. But Liz Truss will sort it out. We're all absolutely confident in lovely Liz. She has the intellect and particularly the long-standing interest and commitment in NHS and social care. Rishi wants to charge everyone £10 for not turning up. And we've tried that before. And the administrative cost of reclaiming the £10, A, is more than the £10. And B, people end up headbutting the receptionist or swearing at the GP and making aggression even worse. So that's a stupid idea. But we still need, you know, still improving public health, improving people's general levels of health, stop people falling into the river of illness instead of fishing them out still is the goal that we really struggle. You know, you walk down any high street and you'll see people of all shapes and sizes who look extremely unwell. And just blaming them for being obese or stressed is not the answer. You know, we have to, and probably start with education, start with kids. We have to improve general levels of fitness. So I come back to the idea of making people COVID fit, fit for life, is really important and boring. But Boris tried it for a while, didn't he? When he got COVID, he went on a bike and went on a few runs for a bit, lost a bit of weight, and then he's put it back on again. It's all gone pear-shaped.
You briefly earlier touched on the question of staffing in relation to COVID, in that if you've got someone working in hospital who has COVID, they will need to isolate still, or they won't be able to work effectively. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yes. I mean, who knows what will change in future because we don't have free tests anymore. They are still testing in the NHS. And it then becomes an argument, isn't it? If you have absolutely no symptoms but are still testing positive, are there some jobs that you could do that aren't direct patient facing? That's possible. Yeah. So some people are well enough to be able to work from home, et cetera, but not to do their face-to-face job. I think it's very difficult. I mean, we may, who knows in the future, they may say, we're just going to stop testing NHS staff. You just don't come in if you've got symptoms. But if you feel well, you come in. And that would obviously be a risk. But you're weighing that up against the risk of having no carers there at all.
Isn't there a problem that the number of symptoms there are which cross over with other conditions which might not prevent a worker from doing their job?
Yeah, that's what makes it so hard. But I just don't know. I think at the very least, we should have prioritised ventilation and air filtration, trying to make environments safer. Independent Sage are going on about this at the moment, and saying, actually, you know, clearly the more transmissible variants can't be stopped. They are so transmissible and clever. We'll all come across them, but we could still significantly reduce the level of all sorts of viruses in indoor spaces with better ventilation, air filtration, and handing out FFP2 masks. So there's no point wearing a cloth masks don't seem to work, and the cheap surgical masks offer minimal protection against more transmissible variants. So it'd be worth at least doing a trial where you ask people to wear these masks and see if it makes a difference. Yeah. So that it's such a complicated mess. I'm not sure what the easy answer is, but I'm doing my best to avoid going to hospital at all. I will be having my booster vaccine, but I accept there are some people who say, well, look, I had unpleasant side effects, or I've already been infected three times and had three jabs I don't want anymore. Hmm. There's still a bit of uncertainty around that. But the autumn boosters are coming for the over 50s and people under 50 with certain conditions and health workers. But we'll see how effective they are.
Just to stay on the staffing thing for a second, one thing you mentioned in your latest columns that you spoke to critical care nurses recently about their working conditions. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that. That was very interesting.
Yeah, I was asked to. I was a late stand-in for somebody who had to pull out with COVID. And they were wonderful.
For an event, as in?
To talk to critical care nurses. They have this network and they're wonderful and they're incredibly dedicated. They don't earn a huge amount of money. But the point is to fix the NHS. It's about listening to frontline staff. So you remember there was this big, amazing cheer when we provided free parking for essential frontline workers during the pandemic. I mean, that's gone now, and they're saying right. You still have to get in an hour before your shift starts to find somebody to park. I mean, yes, it would be great if everyone cycled to work. I get that, or got a bus. But, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you're coming in or whatever, that's hard. Yeah. So there's still all of that. And I think we fail to appreciate the enormity of what we ask people to do. I remember Matt Hancock famously said that PPE is a very precious resource. Rather than saying our NHS staff are a very precious resource. And when we were running short, he was trying to get them not to take it off for a pee, to hold on to your urine for a 12-hour shift so you didn't have to change into another lot of PPE. And nurses got urine infections. They got dehydrated. There were some who admitted to hospital with kidney infections because they got so hot and sweaty and dehydrated and didn't have time to eat and drink. Majority of nurses are women, so they're at a higher risk of they're more likely to be single mums, higher risk of domestic abuse and all sorts of stuff going on. There was one lovely nurse who said, my father-in-law has got an immunocompromised condition. So even though I could have sent my kids to school because I was an essential worker, we tried homeschooling and it's the most stressful thing I've done. It was even more stressful than working on ITU. So it's just listening to the lives of these people as they were going through that. And their normal coping mechanism when you have a tough day on ITU, somebody young has died or something distressing has happened, is you have a chat afterwards. Now, what we could have done is to said, if you're in the same work bubble, it should be okay afterwards to meet in the car park at a reasonable distance and chat through the day. But we didn't. And they very strictly stuck to these rules. So they did this 12-hour shift and then they went home and then they had all this fear about, am I going to pass it on to my family? They weren't sleeping. They got COVID themselves, etc. And there was one of them who told me that we were using bin liners and we were using face visors made by the local primary school at the beginning because it was better than what the NHS were offering. So they've sucked all this up and we still don't really... Thank you. £15 an hour is, I guess, somebody wrote into the eye. I said you could earn that in retail, and they said no, you can't earn that in retail. But it's not a huge amount of money for the complexity of the job that they do. Yeah. And we need to value the staff, and otherwise we lose them. Our issue isn't so much training; it's retaining people who could earn similar wages doing something less stressful. But the most heartwarming thing is they are extremely dedicated. I mean, they talk about the joy of their job, and you're doing something that really matters. Rather than a bullshit job, there are still plenty of people who want to do it, but we have to cherish them and make their jobs more doable. And it's simple stuff, easy hydration, easy food, regular breaks, social connection, maybe somewhere to sleep in hospital would be nice.
Yeah. And that's, just to put that in a bit of context, in your latest column you mentioned there are 100,000 frontline staff vacancies at the moment, which is...
Yeah, but there have been for a long time. And people are saying, ooh, it's all the pandemic. I mean, this was going into the pandemic. We had these vacancies because we'd had 10 years of austerity. And there are lots of Cinderella things. I write about, we always talk about waiting lists and acute care. There are lots of community services. There are kids with learning difficulties and all sorts of community services that have been cut to the bone. People just aren't getting care. I mean, you don't get essential care, even if that's a help with washing, somebody looking on you, you're far more likely to die alone at home, as I think is happening at the moment. I think part of that is because essential community care, health visiting, etc., has been cut back and people living on their own aren't have anyone looking in on them at all.
You've mentioned a lot of different potential solutions in terms of making ourselves more COVID fit. Is there one thing you think is more important than any of the others, or is it a huge combination of all these factors?
I don't know is the honest answer. I've been writing this stuff for 30 years now. I've been privatized and I've been saying much the same stuff. I mean, I think there is an element of responsibility in health. You know, I think we sort of have a duty. I define health as our freedom to live a life we have reason to value that also values others, our ability to avoid harm and to recover from harm, our duty to care for ourselves, to care for others, to care for our planet, and our expectation of decent public services, decent behaviour of our fellow citizens, and a decent death at the end of it. And one of the reasons we got in a pickle with COVID is that a lot of people 60 and above my age haven't planned their death. They haven't made any advance directives. So all of a sudden, people were pitching up in the emergency department, acutely ill with COVID, and nobody knew what their end of life wishes were. If their end of life wishes were, if I get a severe pneumonia, I just want palliative care because I'm 87, I've got dementia, and I don't really need to be in hospital. You know, we would have known that. But so my other big thing is have a think about your end of life wishes. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whether you die of COVID or cardiac failure or cancer. What matters is you have a decent life, a decent death, and we don't screw things up for future generations. And the pandemic has done all three, unfortunately. There's a bit of unpicking. So my project for you, if you haven't already thought about it, and you're of that age where you might die suddenly, you know, how much resuscitation would I want if I got severely unwell? Because generally, the older you are, the less successful it is, and it's much nicer. Having a good dose of the good drugs. My final stress is a good story. A friend of mine, I volunteered to do palliative care during the pandemic, but I said to the hospital, I'd also like to write about it in Private Eye magazine. And they said, no, thank you. Because I wanted to write about what dying from COVID was like to take some of the fear away. It was horrible when you were younger and you were fighting for breath and you were thrashing around like a grounded mackerel or whatever. And until you were intubated, that took away that distress. Older patients, it was less distressing. They were fighting it less. It was still unpleasant. A friend of mine, he did palliative care for the elderly. He said there was one of 99 3/4 who came in from a care home with dementia, who had COVID and was close to dying. And he went, okay, whatever. And she was struggling a bit to breathe. And he turned the oxygen up and she lifted her head off the pillow and she went, oh, shit, that's not a good sign, is it, doctor? 99 3/4. She said he died during the night. She didn't make it to 100. He shed a tear. She didn't make it to 100. But she actually had a reasonably decent death. And people go, oh, everyone died alone. They didn't die alone in hospital and intensive care. They had decent, compassionate workers as surrogate carers for you when you were dying. I think quite a few people died alone at home. But think about your death, because it is going to happen. And a decent death is a good health outcome. It's not something that we should downplay.
Phil Hammond there. And the good news is that if you have been struggling to get an appointment with a doctor, Phil himself is actually offering appointments. Specifically, between the 13th and 27th of August, he will be having two sessions a day at the Edinburgh Festival. One is Dr. Hammond's COVID inquiry, and the other is a look back at his entire medical career called How I Ruined Medicine. You can find out all the details and find out where to get tickets at drphilhammond.com. Do go and check it out. Now we turn to the second half of this week's podcast, a very mysterious deal which has been conducted in part by the British state, helped with British taxpayers' money, and yet which you and I are not allowed to know about. It concerns an outfit, a little-known government department, in fact, called UK Export Finance, or UKEF as it's also known. It's effectively a credit agency. It provides insurance for deals that might be beneficial, but are also rather risky. Effectively, they help British companies access export finance, hence the name. And one very mysterious deal conducted by UKEF caught the eye of Private Eye correspondent Solomon Hughes. Here's Solomon.
I mean, I just look because I'm interested in UKEF because they have a long history of supporting deals which turned out to be corrupt or in other ways dubious. Then I was just looking through their annual report. You know, I just check on boring documents like annual reports, and the UKEF annual report came up. But in there, there's an £809 million export insurance policy, and I think it was one of their biggest deals. It represents 10% of all deals that UKEF were covering, was for an insurance for a British company exporting something to Saudi Arabia, but they wouldn't say what it was, just not disclosed.
That's a lot of money, £809 million. And you're saying that the actual detail of what was being exported...
It's being kept secret. And as far as I can make out, it's going to take ages for us ever to find out. We're not naturally going to find out. I mean, what they said was, as long as the insurance policy is live, that's to say the money hasn't been paid yet, so as long as they're still insuring it, they won't say what the details are because it would create some risk over the deal.
But why?
I found it hard to understand. I think it's possibly because if you're selling 809 millions of let's say it's tins of beans. They're sending 809 million pounds of British tins of beans to Saudi Arabia, but they're worried that the Saudis will decide not to pay or something will go wrong. And so you've had to insure it, and nobody on the open market would insure it, only UKEF would. So I guess they're saying it's an inherently risky deal. And if knowledge of the insurance of this massive tin of beans deal got out, that would somehow jeopardize the deal itself. You know, because it's so inherently risky that even to say what it is would mean, I don't know, that the Saudis will be annoyed that it's been revealed that they've had to get insurance to import £809 million worth of British beans, and in their anger they would refuse to pay, or the firm that's selling the beans would, other companies would not deal with them because they say you're just a kind of risky Saudi bean exporter, we don't want anything to do with you. I don't know, something like that. So I think there's some idea of the inherent risk of a high profile insure, you know, hard to get insurance means that it would
have ramifications commercially.
Something like that. But I mean, if everything was done in secret, that there would be an advantage, you know. I mean, I suppose there's always a risk in telling the truth about something, you know. I could refuse to say anything to anyone about anything I do, because there's a minor risk that if I do, somebody might say, oh, that sounds a bit rum.
So presumably there are ordinary ways, such as, I imagine UKEF falls under the Freedom of Information umbrella, but that this is one of the exemptions that they've deployed, you know, because I know that commercial sensitivity is a reason you can get around Freedom of Information requests. But as you say, almost anything can be defined as commercially sensitive, and, you know, especially in this line of business.
It's challengeable. I mean, I will get round to trying to press them on it, you know, but I mean, I was a bit, to be honest, I was a bit dumbfounded. And I've gone back to them for more detail, but I'm still struggling with their rationale. I think in reality, it's not likely to be beans, because that'd be an awful lot of beans. I think in reality, arms is always a question when you're, UKEF supports a lot of arms. Britain exports a lot of arms. It exports it to really dubious people who might not pay or might get killed before they can pay. Arms is a possibility, but I think it's such a big sum. I think arms is unlikely. I think it's more likely to be a petrochemical processing plant, because when I look through similar deals they've done of that scale, I think that's a possibility. But even that, I can't be sure. Maybe it's one of those, you know, the Saudis are building that mad city in the desert. You know, maybe it's that. Mm.
It's going to be made in modular form in Birmingham and exported. Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think we will. I think I sort of assume it's so big, we will find out. I mean, I did try trying to get a sense of looking around for big deals that are going on. You know, so I kind of assume it will come out at some point, but it did not make me happy, particularly because basically UKEF, you know, if you're dealing with people where it's hard to get insurance to deal with them, it's often because there is an element of corruption. UKEF does have a long, and its predecessors do have a long history of being involved in deals where there's been a suspicion of corruption. And the best way of dealing with potential corruption is, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, but they're keeping us from it. So it made me concerned.
Well, that kind of brings us on to another story that's been in the magazine recently, which is about British relationships with Saudi Arabia, particularly about the, I'm going to get the name right, the Saudi-British Joint Business Council.
Yes, I mean, that was just, to be honest, it's relentless. I mean, it's with the Gulf in general, but with Saudi Arabia in particular. This is, I think it's going back to April. It was Eddie Lister, otherwise known as Lord Udney Lister, just got another job. He gets jobs every now and then.
And we should say who Eddie Lister is before we go any further. So he was a senior advisor to Boris Johnson, particularly during his time as Mayor of London. And then he came back. He was an advisor to Boris Johnson again in Downing Street. It was in lots of different roles.
He has a real key in, particularly to the Johnson government, which I suppose is ultimately coming to an end. But he has a real relationship with government at the highest level. And just because Johnson's gone, it's not like Eddie Lister's contacts will be gone. But he got a job with the Saudi-British Business Council. He's not paid for it, interestingly enough, but he also works for HSBC Bank, and HSBC Bank have huge interests in Saudi Arabia. So it's like really emphasising that his work for HSBC is to help them with the Saudi links. It's like, I mean, just at a very crude level, isn't it? Is the top people in government get work linked to Saudi when they leave government, which means that when they're in government, being friendly to Saudi, just in a very crude level, there's an interest in them for doing that. Yeah. You know, it will help them get jobs afterwards. You know, which is in just in a minor way, in a moral sense, not in a legal sense, but in a moral sense, I think is a corrupting influence, if you like, or it's something that twists our policy on Saudi Arabia. Obviously, there are other things, huge amounts of money. Huge amounts of money will twist politics in a variety of ways. But I think there's also obviously a little thing at the back of their head, or potentially, I imagine there might be a thing at the back of their head saying, well, you know, this is going to help me get a very nice job at the other side.
Akoba took a different view to you. We've done a previous episode on advisory committee on business appointments.
Well, they take the view, they always did. They took a view which they were quite worried about it and concerned about it, and it was an issue and there was a risk. So on balance, they decided that they wouldn't do anything.
Yes.
I mean, they did. They said
the role is unpaid. They said the role at the joint business council is unpaid. So they said, well, in that case, it's less likely it's going to lead to any impropriety.
They said there is a risk he could, Eddie Lister, could have access to relevant privileged information. I mean, he was working for the Prime Minister. He might have access to something and knowledge which could unfairly benefit the Saudi lobby. But because it's unpaid, it didn't matter, which... naive isn't. Maybe it's a naivety, or maybe it's a. It's like Nelson's naivety about ships, isn't it? I can't see any ships because I've put my blind eye up to the telescope. it's a blind eye thing, because the obvious thing is, it's an unpaid role. Why is he taking an unpaid role? Well, because he's got a paid role with HSBC Bank, who love to do business with the Saudis, and our HSBC are in other ways integrated with the Saudi British Business Council, in particular the former UK ambassador to Saudi Arabia, I might pronounce this wrong, Sherard Cowper-Coles. So he's the Britain's former ambassador to Saudi Arabia and famously friendly with the Saudi elite. And he is now an HSBC senior advisor, and also sits on the same Saudi British Business Council board, you know. So, I mean, it's the links are there. I like to think I'm a super hot investigative journalist, but to be honest, it didn't take me long to find that out. I wasn't my hardest sleuthing. So if Akoba couldn't find that out as well, it's because they don't have the resources or the will to find them out.
Just to go back finally to the UKEF deal, the £809 million one, when do you think we might find out what exactly is going on?
I'm not sure, actually. I'm still slightly, I am a little bit perplexed, but I mean, I put it, you know, obviously you like to put things in the magazine that you understand completely rather than you're just shocked by. But in this case, I was a bit perplexed. So, because what they said is, they said, well, it will be discoverable when the insurance is complete, as in when the money is paid up, and so they don't have to insure it anymore. But they won't exactly say when that is. And in some deals, obviously, you're paid in installments. So if you're building this huge petrochemical plant, it's not like, you know, here's your 809 million quid, thank you very much. They might pay them 100 million quid a year, depending on which bits have been erected. So it could be some time. I'm really not clear about that. So yeah, it could be, who knows, could be 5 years time, couldn't it, we find out they've built a prison.
watch this space
for the next 5 years. You will all have to maintain your subscriptions to Private Eye for the next 5 years.
Solomon Hughes there, and the good news is that subscriptions to Private Eye cost substantially less than £809 million. If you would like to get one for yourself and be ahead of all the news, all you have to do is go to private-eye.co.uk and follow the big, handy subscribe here button. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We hope you've enjoyed it. It was produced, as ever, by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. And we will be back again next month with another episode. We'll see you then. Goodbye.